Begin to realize that both Brother Spareback and myself, we enjoy talking. And it might do something to remind you to pray for our seminary. Do you know that our seminarians, they sit 5 hours a day? And they get even tougher stuff than this. And besides that, you know, our seminary, we're really rough. We have a quarter that's actually a week longer than any other graduate institution in the United States. Our quarters are 12 weeks long. And we don't mean 11 weeks and 1 week's the final. We mean 12 weeks long. And if you can look in any catalog of any graduate school and find someone that has one longer, you send it to me and I'll send you an apology. See? Now, do you know what that means? That means every day of seminary, these fellows get an hour of Greek, an hour of Hebrew, an hour of theology, an hour of English Bible, an hour of homiletics or pastoral theology. And we're the only seminary I know of, and I've got catalogs of, well, I've got a lot of them in the garage. I mean it. From almost every seminary. You may not know it, there's 400 and some schools of theology in the United States, so I've got a lot of catalogs. But we're the only seminary I know that we go through 60 of the 66 books of the Bible, and I mean in the original languages, exegetically, for these students. So when they get out, they've gone through, the ones we don't go through are the historical books, and they're kind of hard. Ahaz lived 30 years, and he was a bum, and then he had a son that was worse than he was. So we don't go through those because the fellows can read those in the English. A guy's a bum in English, Hebrew, or Greek. It means all the same. All right? So we go through 60 books that way. And our men get more theology, more Bible, and more Hebrew, and more Greek than any theological seminary in the world, including Dallas Seminary. And I know what I'm talking about. I'm a graduate of there. All right? And so, you see, now when you sit there and you get tired, remember to pray for our students. Because they sit there longer than you do, and they need prayer. All right, shall we bow before the Lord? Our Lord, we love Thee. We know it's only because You first loved us. We didn't start it. We didn't originate it. We're thankful that You're the one that loved us. And as a result, we love You. And so help us to demonstrate that love by keeping the commandments of Christ, which cannot be broken because they're all positive, no negatives, that we're to love one another as Christ loved us, that we're to love one another so the world knows that we're disciples belonging to Christ, that we're to love one another so that we lay down our lives for the brethren. And so, our Father, help us to do those things that are pleasing in Thy sight. And then we'll thank Thee in Christ's name. Amen. Ezekiel 38, and as you're turning there, remember last night we gave you 5 reasons that Russian communism would not rule the world. Now we're going to look at the demise, the destruction of Russian communism. And when God destroys, He's going to do it the right way. And we'll see that tonight, and we'll see it very, very real. Now, not to be outdone, tonight we have a 6-point outline, and we're going to do it this way. We're going to ask, first of all, who's involved in this? Then we're going to ask when, and we're going to ask why, we're going to ask how, what, and then show you the results. And that's it. That's a good way to look at something, isn't it? All right? First of all, who's involved in this? Look at Ezekiel 38, verse 38th chapter and verse 2, and we're going to make some changes for you. Now, there's a little thing in the Hebrew called the construct state, and when the Authorized Version translated this, they missed it, and they turned 2 words around, and it changed the whole meaning. And I want to show it to you. Here's the way it should read. Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog. You see, Gog is the man. Magog is the land he rules over. Now, it's interesting, this word Gog means expander or extender. And that's the man. He's a guy that likes to extend things, expand things. Doesn't that describe a Russian? All right, the land of Magog means the land of expansion. And how would you describe Russia? It's the largest landmass, on the face of this globe, right? It's bigger than China. It sure is. All right, so it should read, Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog. Now watch it. I'm going to change it. You should not read chief prince. It should read the prince of Rosh. The prince of Rosh. Now let me say something. The word Rosh in the Hebrew means head, top. And what a description for this land of Russia. This is where the land Russia came from. If you were looking at a map, what's the top land north of the mountains of Israel? Well, if you draw a meridian line, that's right, meridian goes north and south. All right, if you draw a meridian line right through the mountains of Israel, which are north of Jerusalem there, it'll go within 10 miles of Moscow. Did you know that? Straight north. And then when you get to the edge, you go out in the Barents Sea, and there's nothing there until you get a few little islands out there. So it's the top land. It's the headland. So this is the Prince of Rosh, and the word Russia comes from that, and it definitely means it. Now, there's an authority. I know you read in Baptist Bulletin, it doesn't mean that, but I've got authorities that say it does. That man in Baptist Bulletin is not authority. I know him. Gesenius, in his Hebrew grammar, under the word Rosh, says this means Russia. Now, the man writing for Baptist Bulletin used a really a phony argument. You know the easiest way to win an argument, say, now, that guy's dead, but if he is alive, here's what he'd say. How do you know that's what he'd say? Well, that's what Jacobs, in his article in Baptist Bulletin, said. If Gesenius were alive today, this is what he'd say. Well, that's putting words in the mouth of a dead man. He wouldn't say it at all. He'd say just what he said in his book. All right? Because that's what it means. It means he's the prince of the top land of the land mass. Rosh. And that's what Russia means. It's the top land there. Well, I'm not talking about politically or nobly. I'm talking about geographically. All right? And so, first of all, we have a leader named Gog of the land of expansion. And then it's clarified, he's the prince of Rosh, of Meshech, and of Tubal. And these are the old names for some modern names that you find on your map of Russia, Moscow, and Tobolsk. Been changed since World War II. Stalin didn't like those old names. But you can look at a historical map of Russia and find those names. So here you have a Russian, a prince, a ruler of Russia. And he is involved. Now you should read that again in the third verse. Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, of Meshech, and Tubal. And so you have it. Now, to just to prove it, another side, we really don't need to prove it, but let's look at the location of this land in relation to Israel. And it tells you this twice. Now, I want to look over at the 39th chapter, and I'm going to change something for you, for your part. In the 39th chapter and the second verse, it describes this Russian horde, this Russian armies coming down out of the north parts. Do you see that in the Authorized Version? North parts. Now let's change that and make it good, accurate translation. The uttermost part of the north. That's what it says. The uttermost part of the north. Okay? Now, as I've already told you, if you go north from the mountains of Israel, you can't go any further north than the land of Russia, or you end up in icebergs. It's the top land. You see? Now you have it again. Look over, if you will, in the 38th chapter in the 15th verse. You, Gog, and he's talking to Gog. You see that in the 14th verse? You, Gog, shall come from your place out of the uttermost part of the north. Now, this is different than the king of the north in Daniel 11. He's north of the king of the south. You see, north isn't always north. You see what I mean? If I were to travel north from Oroville, I almost missed it. And then if I were to go over to San Francisco to travel north, but you know, before we got together, we'd have to get clear up the North Pole, and yet both of us traveling north, right? Or if I were over in New York City and going north, and you were in Tacoma, Washington, going north, before we got together, you'd have to travel clear of the North Pole to get together. See, so north is different. You understand? So when it says in Daniel 11, the king of the north, he's north of the king of the south. But here, this guy is the uttermost part of the north from the mountains of Israel. Do you see the difference? All right. Now that verifies that this is talking about Russia. It couldn't be anything else. And you're going to read modern skeptics say, oh no, this is up around the Caspian Sea or the Black Sea. They can have their Black Sea and Caspian Sea. I'll take the uttermost part of the north and Gog and Magog, just like Scripture says. We're literalists. Have you noticed that? I have. All right. Now let's identify some of these others that are involved. Who's involved? Down in the fifth verse, Persia. But Persia has changed. This would be a combination of what we see today as Iran and Iraq. The two that are, well, I guess they got over the war. I don't know. I haven't seen the newspaper for about 4 or 5 days, but they used to be fighting when I read the newspaper. Iran and Iraq. All right? So Persia, old Persia, covered more than modern-day Iran. But it would be not all of Iran. It would be the more southern part and then Iraq. All right? So that's what it's talking about. Now, this tells you something. We've lost Iran, and we will lose Iraq. It will go with the Russians. We should stop pouring our millions into it. You're going to lose it. You're going to lose it. What difference does it make? They're going to get it in the neck. You don't want to help them, do you? All right, so notice what it says, Persia and Ethiopia. That means just what it says. And you know, 50 years ago they laughed at you, but who rules Ethiopia today? Russia. Not Haile Selassie. He's feeding hot dogs somewhere, isn't he? All right, so you have that. Now then, that's what it means. It says, and Libya? Oh, have you heard of that? That's a dirty name, isn't it? Libya? Who influences Libya? What kind of planes do they fly? What kind of tanks do they have? Russia? All right, they laughed at us 25 years ago if you said that, didn't they? Now then, that's the... Now, Gomer in the sixth verse, Germany, West Germany. East Germany. And then Togarmah. Togarmah is the old country of Armenia, which is the modern country of Turkey and the upper part of Iran. It's Turkey, and again, we're going to lose Turkey. Turkey's going to go in the communist orbit. It says so here. What do you care? They ain't going to hit us. All right? It's going to happen. So it says so here. You have it. Now, these are all of the ones that will be involved. Now, the opposing team. The opposing team, the Western bloc of powers. Turn over to the 13th verse. Sheba and Dedan. Sheba and Dedan are approximately the two-thirds of the Arabian Peninsula south. You have Yemen, South Yemen, Kuwait and some of the Saudi Arabia, those are involved in the old Sheba and Dedan. It's about, well, let's make it a half of the Arabian Peninsula. All right? It's the oil countries. And we're going to see that's interesting because we're going to see a warning. Don't spoil the oil. You ever heard that? There's one in Scripture. We'll look at it. All right? And so you have Sheba and Dedan, and they are Arabs. Then let's look at the next. The merchants. Now this word for merchants is unusual, and it doesn't mean Kmart type merchants. This means mercantile merchants. You know what mercantile merchants are? They're the ones that do their merchandising by ship. Yeah. So the merchants of Tarshish. Now what does the word Tarshish mean? It means tin isles. Tin isles. You know, tin is one of those rare metals. Until gold went skyward, when it used to be depression prices, $30 an ounce, that wasn't too long ago, as I remember it, tin was almost as valuable as gold. So when we used to call the old Ford a Tin Lizzie, we were saying, boy, that thing is really priceless. Oh, you thought you were riding the thing. Man, I wished it were made out of tin and I had a million of them. All right. Tin is a rare metal. It's only mined today in Venezuela and over in the Indonesian countries. But you know where the Roman Empire mined tin? And you can look this up in the Encyclopedia Britannica. They mined it in the British Isles when Rome owned the British Isles. What would describe Britain? If you took all the ships away from Britain, what would they get their marmalade? I've heard they like marmalade. Okay. How do they get their marmalade? Well, they send those ships over to hot countries that grow citrus fruit, and they bring it back, and they get their marmalade. You see? Britain is a mercantile, merchant country, and if you cut off the sea lanes to Britain, Britain would almost starve. This is talking about Britain. This is talking about Britain. This is saying the Arabs and the Tin Isles. And this would be Britain. Now, notice it's describing countries, and then it's going to change to a metaphor. So these metaphors are describing countries. Look at it. It says Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish. Now, those are three countries. Now it says the young lions of the Tin Isles. Now, what do the young lions stand for when you're talking about nations? The young, strong, virile nations that Britain brought forth. Now, what nations did Britain bring forth? Well, if Britain hadn't had a toehold in what we now call the United States, this would be New France. Do you know that? Sure would. It was the British and the French supposing, and then us being contrary cusses revolting, that gave you the United States. Without the British, there would be no United States. How about Canada? Well, they've still got some consequences, haven't they? There's one little province called Quebec because there were some French settled there, but the rest of it, what? The English took it. And just recently, the Queen gave it back to them in name. All right? So this is talking about United States and Canada. Do you see why? It isn't really talking about lions. It's talking about countries, and it's using a figure of speech, a metaphor, to describe some other countries that the Tin Isles produced. And it describes them in terms of strong, virile, rugged, vicious countries. Now, these are countries that are going to oppose. You see, now you have two blocks of power. You have the Russians and their satellites, and you have a Western block of powers. Now, I believe, it doesn't say, but I believe included in England here is going to be the rest of that revived Roman Empire. It doesn't say that. But since it names east part of Germany, quite probably the west part of Germany will be along with England. You see? And so you have a Western block of powers, at least the United States, Canada, and the British Isles. And over here you have Russia and her satellites that drift down toward Israel. All right? So this is the who of the scenario. Now then, when? When will this scenario take place? Well, first of all, it's going to be after an intensive preparation for war on Russia's part. I mean intensive, more than what we have now. They're just keeping us on a string, just building enough to keep ahead of us and thumbing their nose at us when we say we'd like to cut back. All right? Now, notice very definitely it tells you this. It says it's going to be after an intensive time of preparation. Look at the 7th verse, if you will. Well, and you'll notice, here's God's admonition to them. Be thou prepared. Now, he's talking to God, Gog, and he says, you get prepared. And prepare for yourself, thou and all of your company that are assembled unto thee. And you be a commander unto them. Now that word guard should be commander. That word guard should be commander. You be a commander unto them. Now this is going to be an intensive time of preparation. And you can see that it's there. And also up in the latter part of the 4th verse. And I will bring thee forth, and all thine army, and horses and horsemen, and all thy, all them clothed with all sorts of armor, even great company with bucklers and shields, and all them that handle swords. Now let me say something. I'll prove to you in a minute there are not going to be any horses here. Ezekiel is describing the most advanced type of warfare that he knew centuries ago. There's no way he could tell you about tanks. There's no way he could tell you about airplanes. But he is going to describe an airlift. It couldn't be anything else. So he's telling you in the terms that he lived, in the day that he lived, this was the most advanced type warfare he knew. But there aren't going to be any horses because you're going to have worldwide famine. That's why Russia's coming down against Israel. We'll show it to you in a minute. And if they had horses, they'd eat horse meat and thumb their nose at Israel. Well, they wouldn't give a coodly-oo about Israel if they had horses. And they don't. This is when 500 years, 600 years before Christ, Ezekiel is led by the Holy Spirit to use the most advanced type warfare they then had. But that's not what we use now. And it's not going to be that. It'll be tanks and airplanes, and it won't be horses and swords. All right? There's no way a Russian is going to give up his rifle, automatic fire rifle, for a sword. But that was the most advanced warfare back there, and that's the only terms Ezekiel could use. If he had spoken about an airplane back there, for centuries nobody would know what it was. He wouldn't have known until 1900. You see? So he uses the terms of advanced warfare that he knew. And each generation that came along and advanced the warfare, they could add their warfare in there. That's simple enough. All right, now, it's going to be after a tremendous, visible surge of preparation on the part of Russia for this warfare. And you can see it there. Now, it's also at a time when Israel will be at peace and does not need to protect themselves. Now, that's not true today. If you've seen any of your newsreels of this present war, and if they take pictures in the kibbutzes or around Jerusalem, about every Israelite's carrying a little Uzi machine gun, and they are armed to the teeth. But you see, after the man of lawlessness makes that seven-year covenant and promises to protect them, they don't try to protect themselves. They live at peace. Now, look at it. It will be a time of peace. It's going to say that. Look, if you will, at the last part of the 8th verse. Against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but have been brought forth out of the Gentiles, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. And then look at the 11th verse. Thou shalt say, I will go up into the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, them that dwell safely, all of them, dwelling without walls, without fortification, and having neither bars nor gates. Now, this picture is an Israel completely at peace, completely at rest. They are not even protecting themselves. They don't have border guards. They don't have sentries at the street corners. This is a Israel at peace, and that's only after the man of lawlessness makes a seven-year covenant before he breaks it right at midterm. And they will have peace. They don't have peace today. It's going to change right at mid-trib. Then they're going to have to flee down the wilderness, and there will be no Jews in Jerusalem for 3.5 years. They'll be down in a place in the wilderness where they flee, and there won't be Jews in Jerusalem. There'll be Gentiles. There won't be one Jew, that false prophet, and he will be setting up the image of the first beast of Revelation 13. So it's going to be after a time of intensive preparation on Russia's part. It's going to be when Israel's at peace in the first part of the tribulation period. And it's going to be when God starts putting thoughts in the Russian leader's mind. Now, I want you to see this. This is the most interesting. This shows the will of man and the sovereignty of God. This man thinks he thinks he gets the idea. But he doesn't get the idea. God puts a thought in his head, and he says, boy, wasn't I smart, I thought of that. Now, let me show it to you twice, God says it. Look down, if you will, at the 10th verse and the 11th verse. Then we're going to look back at the 4th verse and see why the fellow's really coming down. He's coming down against Israel because God's got a hook in his jaw and pulling him. But he said, oh, I'm smart, I figured it out. I'm going to do it because I want to do it. Yes, that's just how you believe. You said, I want to believe. And God said, I know it. I gave you the faith to believe, and you're going to use it. You certainly are. All right, now look at the 10th verse. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall come to pass that at the same time, that's the same time that he's preparing there, the 7th verse, that same time goes up to the 7th verse. It doesn't go to the 9th verse. It shall come to pass at the same time that you're preparing, the same time you're getting your armies together, it shall come to pass at the same time shall things come into your mind, and you shall think an evil thought, and you shall say,
I will go up to the land of unwalled village. I will go up to them that are at rest. Do you see what it says?
God put a thought in his mind. He says, boy, I'm going to do it. But look back at the fourth verse and see why he's really doing it. Back at the fourth verse. And I will turn thee back and put hooks in your jaws, and I'll bring you forth and all your army. Why is he going forth? Because the sovereign God says, it's my plan and I want you to go forth, and you're gone.
That's right.
So you've got a perfect picture of the sovereignty of God and the will of man here. Man can only will in the realm that he has any consciousness about. How can you will about something you don't even know is going on? All right? That's right. And this is the perfect picture. So this will happen after an intensive time of preparation. It'll happen at a time when Israel's at peace. It can't happen now. It can't happen before the rapture. It can't happen until after the man of lawlessness makes a peace treaty with Israel and says, I'll protect you. I'll give you protection. Now, it has to happen just before mid-trib, and we'll show you why. It's when God puts a thought in the ruler's mind and he takes it his own, and God puts hooks in his jaws and pulls him down and he can't go any other place. There's another illustration. I think it's the 20th chapter of the book of Ezekiel, where Nebuchadnezzar is going up. He has two revolting colonies. Nebuchadnezzar was the Babylonian Empire. And over here he had the city of Jerusalem was revolting against him, and Samaria was revolting against him. And he comes into the split of the way and he says, which way should I go? Should I go up there and take care of them first or them? And he wanted to go up to Samaria. So he threw an arrow in the air and it came down toward Jerusalem. Let's forget that. Let's cut an animal open, look at his liver. He cut an animal open, look at his liver. So it's Jerusalem. He said, I want to go up there. So he said, well, let's try it again. And so he tried something else that's still pointing to Jerusalem. So he went down to Jerusalem because God wanted the city of Jerusalem to be sieged and a third of the city of Jerusalem to be taken captive back to Babylon. And he went. That's the sovereignty of God and the will of man. You see, Nebuchadnezzar didn't realize probably there's an angel turning that arrow, turning that liver, and turning everything else to point to Jerusalem every time. And he couldn't will something he didn't know wasn't happening. You can only will in the realm of your creaturely or human consciousness, and you can't will beyond that. But you know all kinds of things go on outside of the realm of your humanly consciousness that determine how you're going to choose to cause you events that you have no control over that force you to make a choice. That's what's happening to the Russian. That's what's happened to the Russian. You see? All right. And so you have the sovereignty of God. It will happen because God puts hooks in his jaws. But the old boy, he takes that thought, put in his mind. He said, well, I thought it up. I'm pretty smart. I'm going to do it. And he didn't know that it was put in his mind by somebody he didn't see and somebody he didn't feel and somebody he wasn't aware of. And he didn't even know it was being put in his mind. And so he willed as a result of that. Now, why is Russia coming down against the nation Israel? Well, we've heard for years to get the potash out of the Dead Sea. They don't give any credence to the Dead Sea. You know why they're coming down? Because they're hungry. They're hungry. I'll show you. There's going to be worldwide famine, except for the land of Israel. Now, let me show you something. It's most interesting, and I'll bet you've read it and haven't noticed it. You'll notice in the 11th and 12th verses, this is what the Russian ruler is saying. And notice, never once does he mention silver or gold or money or jewels or anything. Here's why he says he'll go down against Israel, and let me read it to you. Thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil, to take a prey, to turn thy hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, on the people that are gathered out of the Gentiles, which have gotten cattle and goods. Now you notice he doesn't mention a thing about money. He says there's food down there. They got beefsteaks and they got canned goods and they've got rice and they've got wheat. That's what goods means. That's what I'm going to take. It's only when the diplomatic protestation of his invasion comes that they mention gold. Look down. This isn't what he says. This is what the others say. Look down, if you will, at the 13th verse.
these opposing Western bloc of powers plus the Arabians shall say unto you, are you come to take a spoil? Have you gathered your company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, and to take away cattle and goods, and to take a great spoil? Now you see, the Russian didn't say that. That was the Americans that accused him of it. All right, do you see the difference? Sure, you know that every day. Khrushchev will say, hey, you Americans are doing this, and our ambassador say, no, we're not doing this, we're doing that. All right, that's simple enough. They're going down to get food. Now, why food? Well, turn over to Revelation, the 6th chapter, and you'll see there's going to be worldwide famine. In fact, a fourth of the inhabitants of the earth is going to die. And you know how many people that is? Well, just take rough figures. They say 4 billion is plus now. Every hour, a little more plus. Well, let's take 4 billion. I can figure 4 because I've got 4 fingers. If you kill off one-fourth of them, you're killing a billion people, and that's more people than have been lost in all the wars and accidents and fires and famines of all of the history of mankind. That's what it means. Now let's look at it. Revelation 6. This is the famine. This is the background on which you see Ezekiel 38, because this is the first part of the tribulation period in Revelation 6. Look at the third horseman. Now, these horsemen are not persons. They're conditions or states. You can see that by the fourth horseman. The fourth horseman is death. Death is a condition or state. It is not a person. I'll never forget the time in Denver in Beth Eden Church. I preached that. And as I went out to lunch, there was a man followed me. And he followed me down the church steps. And when we got to the sidewalk, he started yelling at me, death is to a person! Death is to a person! Well, I thought the guy was a nut, so I kept on walking. And he ran a whole block after me, shouting at me that death is a person. So I turned around and I said, all right, fellow, suppose death is a person. Why don't we get rich? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, death is a person. Naturally, death has this person has to come close to another person to kill him, to cause him to die. So you find out who this person death is, and we'll get rich by warning people when he comes close to them so they can get away, and we'll charge for it. He said, aw, you. Well, aw, him. You see, death isn't a person. Death is a state that you enter into when your soul and spirit leaves your body. So death is not a person. Now, the fourth horseman is not a person. Good exegesis and good hermeneutics says neither one of the other horsemen are persons. The first horseman, the white horseman, is that state of peace that begins the tribulation, but it's powerless because the man has a bow but no arrows. I saw that when we went through the UN building. I'm going to make a confession of my sins. I paid $2.75 to go through the UN building. I wouldn't do it again, but I did it once. And I saw a big banner in the UN building. Peace will conquer all. Now, that's exactly what it's saying here. This white horseman goes forth to conquer. Peace will conquer all. Well, this is what we told you. The beginning of the tribulation period begins with a time of peace. Then you have war, and you can see that simply because it says the second horseman was given to him to take peace from the earth. That proves the first horseman is peace. If the second horseman is to take peace from the earth, and then what's the first horseman? All right, you can see that. The red horseman, power was given to him to take peace from the earth. That's war, isn't it? We'll tell you about that war some other time. Not this time, all right? That's not this that we're talking about. This war here is when that beast has to kill three of the kings to keep his power over the 10 kings. You see, we didn't go into that, and let's not. Now, the third horseman is famine, worldwide famine. And you notice that you have to work a whole day, a day's wages. This penny here is not a penny. If you look at the margin, the denarius, that's a day's wages for a quart of wheat. Now, you ladies that grind your own wheat, how much bread could you make out of a quart of wheat? And you work all day for it and feed your family on a quart of wheat. And why just a quart of wheat? Because there's famine, brother. There's famine. These scales here are to weigh the wheat, not to weigh your deeds. All right? Or you can get 3 quarts of barley. That's not such good food. It makes beer, but not good food. All right? And so you have here. Now notice the unusual statement down below. Don't hurt the oil. Don't hurt the oil. What did we see? Who's going to help? Who's going to help the Western bloc of powers destroy Russia? People with oil. And don't hurt the wine.
Don't hurt the wine. Now, that means they're growing grapes. There's some production down there. But the rest of the world, the rest of the world is in famine. And look at the result of it. As a result of it, you have pestilence and death. You have pestilence and death killing one-fourth of the population of the earth. And notice how you can see famine going through. It says the beasts of the field will be so hungry, they're going to kill people. Did you see it, the last part of the verse? When will beasts kill people? When they're hungry. When there's no little rabbits because they can't find any little turnips. And the people are around. Beasts will kill people. Did you see it? It says right there in the last part of the verse. It says, to kill, this horseman will go forth with powers given him over a fourth part of the earth, to kill with the sword and with hunger, hunger, hunger. What's hunger go with? Famine. And famine always follows warfare. Famine, war, to kill with the sword and with hunger and with death and with the beasts of the earth. Beasts of the earth are going to get so hungry. I read, was it 2 years ago, that because of those brush fires around L.A., that little rodents and things were killed off, and the coyotes were coming right into L.A. and taking dogs and cats out of the backyards for their food. You see, if they get hungry enough, they take you too if they find you. All right? And so the world has famine, but Israel's got cattle and goods. That's why Russia's coming down. They're not coming down to drain the Dead Sea and get all of the potash. They're coming down to get some cattle. They're hungry. Their bellies are empty. Now do you see how foolish it is to say they're riding a whole army of horses down? Why don't they eat the horses? Horse meat tastes just as good as cow if you don't know what you're eating. I know. I ate it during World War II. All right? Well, you just close your eyes and go away, and it tastes pretty good. All right? I lived in San Diego. We weren't getting any cattle down there, but we were getting fish and horse meat, and so I ate a little bit of both. All right. It tastes pretty good. It really does. It's redder and sweeter than beef, but it tastes pretty good. It didn't bite me first, and I could digest it, so I ate it. All right. Now then, do you see why Russia's coming down to get cattle and goods? Goods, do you mean just what it means? Corn and wheat. They don't care about the silver and gold. That's the Americans. Say, you're going to pick up silver and gold too? You see? Well, I'm sure if there's a gold coin laying there and there's a basket of corn, they would pick them both up. But they came for the corn. All right? Now it's because, why are they coming down? They're coming down because they're hungry, because there's worldwide famine, because a fourth of the people of the earth are dying from famine and the sword and from the wild beasts eating them. 1 billion people! And Russia doesn't want to starve to death. And so she comes down against Israel because God is starting to move in Israel, and Israel has crops, and this beast up here is protecting Israel. And so they're going to come down. And they're going to try to get cattle and goods. They were accused also of taking gold and silver, but that isn't what the Russian ruler said he was coming for. He says, I'm coming for cattle and goods. And it's because they're hungry. Now, how will they come? Well, they're going to come with an airlift. They're not going to come with horses. And I want you to look at the 9th verse and see if this describes horses. I want you to look at the 9th verse. If you were living 2,000 years ago, and then you went to sleep and woke up in 1980, and you saw at an airport all the activity going on, would you connect this? You see? All right, let's look at it. Thou shalt ascend! Well, that could be getting up on the back of a horse, but that's not much ascension. You shall ascend and come like a storm. You shall be like a cloud to cover the land. Thou and all thy bands, and many people with thee. The whole bunch is coming this way. Now that doesn't sound like horses romping all over the steppes to me. That sounds like Ezekiel 600 years before Christ, not knowing how to describe it any other way. He says, you're going to come in the air like a cloud. You're going to cover the whole land. You're going to ascend. And that's never used of just taking your feet off the ground like this. All right? So they're going to come with an airlift, I'm sure of it. There's no reason in the world why Russia would go back to horses when they could be eating them, and that's the whole thing, the whole purpose of going down to the land of Israel is to get some food. They would eat the horses, and they do, they have, and they will. And if you read anything about when Napoleon invaded Russia, why, they ate their donkeys that pulled their caissons. Remember, Napoleon went into Russia and got chased out, and he had a pretty bad defeat. And they ate their donkeys coming out. They were so hungry. So it wouldn't make sense to be riding a bunch of horses down to go get some food. All right, and I'm sure that's not true. So this is why they're coming down. They're coming to get food because they're starving. The rest of the world is starving. But Israel, unusually, because of God's providence, they must have grass because they have cattle. And they must be able to raise crops because they've got goods. And so God has started to work with Israel. And they've got food when the rest of the world is starving. And this, by the way, is the background on when that parable of the so-called talents, which should be called the parable of the money, in Matthew 25 takes place. It's not for the church. It's for these people right here. All right? Now they're coming with an airlift. All right? Now, we want to look at what takes place. Well, the Western bloc of countries are going to be used by God as a sword to destroy the Russians. And God will take the credit for it. And the Western bloc of countries will be used as a sword to destroy Russia. And God will take the credit for it, and it will be done by a nuclear war. It will be done by a nuclear war that's fought right. And not the way we fought in Vietnam. And I want to show you this very, very emphatically. Notice God says, that in the 21st verse, now this is not chronological, the sword will be called before there's a great shaking in the land and the fallout. He's just telling you in the middle of it, verse 21, why there was a great shaking in the land and why there's a fallout. So verse 21 says, I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith the Lord God. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. Now when God calls a sword against anyone, it's calling a nation to use them as his mode of destroying the other nation. I want to show you how this is used numerous places. But first, I want to show you how God used the Assyrian army as an axe to chop down Israel, the 10 tribes. And then because the axe said, I did it, God destroyed the axe. You see what I'm saying? God used the human army, the Assyrians, to take into captivity the 10 tribes, and then when the Assyrians said, we did it, God said, I'll destroy you, because God did it. You see? Now look at, if you will, before we look at the swords, look at Isaiah 10. I want you to see this in Isaiah 10. It's a beautiful picture. This is the when God is going to take by the king of Syria, he's going to take them into captivity, the 10 tribes, and he's going to use them as an axe to hew down the nation Israel. And then because the axe boasted it, he did it, he's going to break the axe. All right, now notice, if you'll do it very carefully, starting with the 12th verse, you notice, I'll punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. For he has said, by the strength of my hand I've done it, and by my wisdom and my prudence I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures and I've put down their inhabitants. My hand has found it. Now look what he says in the 15th verse. Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Or the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? And if the rod shall shake itself against them that lift it up, as if the staff should lift itself up to the word. Therefore, saith the Lord of hosts shall send among his fat ones leanness. He said, I'm going to judge you, because you claimed the victory, and I'm the one that sent you in there against the nation Israel. Now, that's how God is going to destroy the Russians. He's not going to do it by saying destroy. He's going to send a sword, and that sword is the Western bloc of powers with their nuclear weapons. And we'll show it to you. Now let's look at some places where the word sword is used of human armies, and in the sense that we've said. Let's look back at Jeremiah, the 9th chapter, And the 16th verse, and again you have there God calling another nation against the Jewish nation to punish them for being backsliding, and that word is used in this area. All right, and so in Jeremiah 9:16, and you'll notice if you read back, it's because they've forsaken the law in the 13th verse, and they've gone after Balaam, several Baals, that's plural Baals. I will scatter them among the heathen, among the Gentiles, whom neither they nor their fathers have known. I will send a sword after them till I have consumed them. Now that sword was a human army. It wasn't a sword hanging on a thread flying after them. All right? It was a human army that God sent after them. And then in Jeremiah 25:29, you have it. If you want to look there. The sword is another army used in God's hand like He used the Assyrians like an axe. But the axe better not boast it did it. Remember, that was the undoing of Nebuchadnezzar. He looked out over the great Babylon with its hanging garden. He said, look at the great city I built. God says, go insane for 7 years, you dummy. That's just what He did. He sent him insane, made him live out with the cattle for 7 years. You read it in the 4th chapter of the book of Daniel. It's all there. All right. And so here you have him using again a sword. Jeremiah 25:29. For lo, I begin to bring evil on the city that is called by my name, and shall be utterly should ye be utterly unpunished, you shall not be unpunished, for I will call for a sword upon all the inhabitants of the land. Now here the earth should be land. It's Haaretz. It's talking about the land of Palestine. You see, a sword in God's hand is when He uses another army to punish somebody else. And that's just what He's going to do. You have it also in Ezekiel, all the way through it. I tried to get another book except Ezekiel, but you can look at it in Ezekiel 5:17. We'll give you some other verses you can look up yourself. And it means an army that God sends. And let's see. Now, this describes how a sword was. What was to happen here in the city of Jerusalem? One third was to go to die of famine and pestilence. One third was to go die by the sword when Nebuchadnezzar came in, and one third was to be scattered or be taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar. And he says, "I'll draw out a sword after them." So there. Now, give me the. I'll give you the others. We don't want to look them up. Ezekiel 11:8 and Ezekiel 21:9, where again a sword is a human army used in God's hand to destroy or to punish the nation Israel, and in this case, a sword to destroy the Russians. All right. Now let's look at how this destruction takes place. It takes place by an earthquake that is not a seismic activity. Now, if the fault starts slipping in California, like we hear the rumors over in Oregon that half of California is going to slip into the ocean, the fish out there in the ocean are going to be feeling that. And people standing on the earth are, but birds flying 100 feet up in the air aren't going to feel it. You see? But look at this earthquake. It says, "For in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken, surely in that day there shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel, so that the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the heaven," the fowls of the heaven, the fowls of the heaven, "and the beasts of the field and all creeping things that creep on the earth and all men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence, and the mountains shall be thrown down and steep places shall fall and every wall shall fall on the ground." Now let's look at the results of that. Let's look down. And you notice you have here the perfect description of a fallout of a nuclear device. You see, I've talked to nuclear men that are conversant in it. If you explode a nuclear device and there's a pond of water, that nuclear device is going to suck the pond of water up, and as it gets up in the atmosphere, it's going to turn to ice. And it'll come back in hailstones, but some of that, if it's small enough, will melt by the time, and it'll rain on you. You're also going to have big boulders. You see? Now, this is describing the fallout of a nuclear explosion. Look at it. "I'll plead against them with pestilence and blood. I'll rain upon him and upon the bands of many people are with him. An overflowing of rain." There's the water that was sucked up and has melted. "And great hailstones." That's the water that was sucked up and froze in big chunks. You see it? and fire and brimstone. That's how they... Now, there's something else. When you look at the burial parties that's going to bury the carnies as a result of this, they have a perfect description of people that have had radiation poisoning. Because it tells you, we're not going into, you read it yourself, you'll find it over in the 39th chapter and starting with the 11th verse. It tells you these people, if they're wandering through the wilderness and see a body, don't touch it. Put a marker there and leave, and let a burial party come along and bury it. You see? Now this will be a nuclear war. But this is in the tribulation, and notice the earth is still standing. It shakes a bit, but it's still there. Men aren't going to blow it out of the sky. God tells you that if you look at 2 Peter 3. Men are foolish. They've got a... I don't believe that if you dropped all the atomic bombs in the world that it would blow up this earth. They tell us that when St. Helens went off, it was equivalent to 250 of the atomic bombs that exploded at Nagasaki. And it really isn't that much devastation. I know I had that much ash on my house and everything else, but it isn't that much devastation. Killed 69 people and blew a little bit of earth out. It's still there. I look out at my driveway and see Mount St. Helens every day. A little flat-topped, but it's still there. It's still there. Well, I think these scientists have an exaggerated opinion. You know that some of the scientists didn't want us to drop the atomic bombs on Japan because they thought it would be a continuous thing that the neutrons would keep exploding all over the earth and destroy the whole earth from those two dinky little bombs? I've got proof of that. You see, they don't know what's going to happen, those kooks. They sit in their glass cages and try to tell us what's going on. God says it will, the earth is good for 1,007 years, and when it's destroyed, He's going to push the button. That should be good enough. Oh, they're going to knock it off course a couple times. They will. They're going to change the actual axis of the earth a couple times. But they're not going to destroy it. That's right. I don't worry about Russia blowing up the earth. If they did, they'd just give me a supercharge to heaven. What in the world is wrong with that? For crying out loud. All right. Now then, let's look at what else happens. Now, you go down to the 39th chapter, and I want to change something. That second verse is wrong. They mistook a Hebrew word. They thought it was a numerical value, and it's not. Here's the way the second, and I'll prove it to you from the next verse. Otherwise, you've got a contradiction. I will turn thee back and will bring thee on. Now, there's nothing about a sixth part. Mark out that sixth part. All of them are going to be destroyed. Every one of them will be destroyed. Look at the next verse, the two verses down. Thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, and all, A-L-L, not 5-6. You can't have all and yet have a 6 left over. That's a contradiction. And so he says, I will turn thee back and lead thee on, and will cause thee to come up from the uttermost part of the north, and will bring thee into the mountains of Israel, and I'll smite the bow out of your left hand, and will cause the arrows to fall out of your right hand, and you shall fall upon the mountains of Israel, you and all of your bands, and the people that are with you, and I will give you unto the ravenous birds of every sort, and to the beasts of the field to be devoured. Now all of that Russian horde, and those Iranians, and those Iraqis, and those Turks that come on down, and those Libyans and those Ethiopians that come over, they're all going to die on the mountains of Israel. But God doesn't stop there. God fights the war the right way. He's going to go back and destroy the homeland of Russia and the homeland of Turkey and the homeland of Iran. That's the way you fight a war if you want to win it. Proof? Let's look. And I will send a fire on Magog. What was Magog? The land in which Gog came from, which is the land of Russia. I will send a fire on Magog, and among them that dwell safely or at ease on the satellites. Now the isle here is a word that describes a number of things in the Hebrew. It could be islands of the sea or the sea coast, or satellite countries, countries that border on others. Here it's those satellite countries bordering on Russia that came with Russia, you see. So it's not islands, these are the satellites. And so the satellite countries that helped Russia are going to get bombed also. That's right. Well, if you win a war, you win it. You don't piddle around and play patty cake. If you don't want to win it, stay out of it. Right?
And so he says,
so this is what's going to happen, you see. Not only is the armies that come down going to be destroyed there on the mountains of Israel, every one of them. And notice how much fighting has Israel done? Not a lick. Not a lick. It's been the Western Towers. Pretty smart old Begin, isn't he? He makes the wads and let us shoot them. Okay, they're cunning, they're shrewd, they're smart. And notice that's what's going to happen. Then not only that, there's going to be destruction back on the homelands for sending these armies out.
All right, now the results, and then we're through. The results. First of all, many Gentiles are going to realize now that there is a God in heaven and this stuff doesn't happen by accident. Look up at the 23rd verse of the 38th chapter. Thus, by destroying, by this nuclear holocaust, by destroying this, thus I will magnify myself and set myself apart from any others. That's what sanctify means. And I will be known in the eyes of many Gentiles, many nations, and they shall know that I am Jehovah. Let's look at the next results. Look down at the 7th verse of the 39th chapter. That dealt with Gentiles up there. Some of the Gentiles are going to wake up and say, hey, those little bitty old dinky Jews down there, and the Russians went down there, and then where are the Russians? Look at the Jews, they're still there. Hey, that's got to be more than an accident. You see? That's the Gentiles. Now let's look at the Jews. Here's the Jews, they got saved. What's going to happen to them? I mean saved physically. Look down at the 7th verse of the 39th chapter. So will I make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel, by destroying not only Gog and his armies, but by destroying their home countries. In that way, I will make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel, and I will not let them pollute my holy name anymore. And the heathen, the Gentiles, the nations, that's the same word as nation over in the 23rd verse of the 38th chapter. The heathen, the nations, the Gentiles shall know that I am the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. You see, that's what God's going to accomplish by this. God's got a program and a reason for destroying Russia. He's got a program and a reason for letting Russia coast today, letting Russia get ready to go into the tribulation when it comes and go in there, because God's going to get glory to himself by destroying Russia. So don't you try to destroy it before God wants to destroy it. And don't get upset at Russia today. God's got his hands on all of this. When God puts hooks in the jaws, that old Russian's going down there. But until God puts hooks in the jaws, he's not going down. And when God puts hooks in his jaws, he's not turning around either. He's going. You see, God has a plan for Russia. That's why God has allowed that godless, atheistic country to exist. God's going to let it go down against his people, Israel, so that he can show he's God. And the Jews are going to wake up and say, hey, we better be careful how we use his name. He's the Holy One of Israel. We better not pollute his name. He's dealing with us now. God isn't dealing with the Jews today, but in the tribulation, he will. And they're going to start knowing it when God protects them supernaturally against that Russian horde and destroys it. See, there's a part in God's plan for everything, isn't there? The ants and the skunks and the monkeys, the Jews and the Russians and the Syrians and the Iraqis. God's got a plan for all of it. And it's all for his glory. And he will get glory to himself when he destroys Russia by using a sword, a Western bloc of powers. And here you find the United States. The next time you find her, she's going down to the Battle of Armageddon, and she, in turn, will get destroyed. She, in turn, will get destroyed. But I don't care. I won't be here. It won't be the America I love. It'll be an entirely different one. Let's bow before the Lord. Our Father, we're thankful now for your goodness. We're thankful for these things we've seen. We're thankful for the truth of them. This is history pre-written. Men have maligned. They've tried to change it. They've added to it. They've